I'll start kind of slowly as people come in. I think the goal of today's talk is going to bring you up to the beginning of Matt's first talk last week. So the goal of the entire series was to say some things about boundaries and defects in topologically twisted theories and the sorts of algebraic structures they have. But more importantly, given the theme of the school, I wanted to explain how one goes about analyzing these structures from a physical perspective or a physical mindset. And I don't know how to analyze any problem, almost, without, well, most things I think about start from fields and Lagrangians. And in fact, I will try to simplify any problem to the extent that I can get some intuition for it from free field theory. And a lot of the examples I'll discuss today and this week will really come from free field theory, and then we'll take the intuition from free fields and try to bootstrap it up to more interesting structure. The reason that today's talk is going to be almost entirely about, well, it's going to be entirely about quantum mechanics. I'll get to supersymmetric quantum mechanics at the end, but I actually want to go back to just some very basic things in quantum mechanics, is because I'd sort of like to form at least a very thin chain of logic from basic fields and Lagrangians to algebraic things happening with operators and Hilbert spaces. Okay, so as a perspective for the rest of the week, this afternoon, you will hopefully be rederiving Matt's Durham quantum mechanics during the problem session. And then on Wednesday, I'll use this to talk about A models and B models in two dimensions and the sorts of operator algebras they have on their boundaries. And hopefully on Friday, I'll paint a bigger picture of how to analyze boundaries and defects in higher dimensional theories by reduction to two dimensions or to one dimension. And so another reason that this whole discussion of quantum mechanics is incredibly important is because all of the fancy computations done in very high dimensions ultimately get reduced to some statement in quantum mechanics, possibly with a very infinite dimensional space of fields. Okay. So, basics. I want to start with bosonic quantum mechanics. And consider a particle moving on a line whose position at time t is given by some function x of t. This translates to a one-dimensional QFT with space-time being the line of time and the target being the line of x, the line that the particle moves on, and the fields in this theory are the space of fields is the space of the space of trajectories. Which you could think of as C infinity. Functions on RT, or as sections of an RX bundle over RT. I'll work in Euclidean time. It doesn't really matter. In quantum mechanics, it will make a difference in higher dimensions. In sort of go in parentheses here, it affects some factors of I. The action is then an integral over time of the first derivative of x squared for a free particle. The only sorts of interactions, well, the basic sorts of interactions one can introduce for a free particle involve a potential. I will also go back and forth between writing time derivatives explicitly and just writing them as a dot. Obviously, the dot looks nicer and is more convenient, but sometimes one needs the other notation. To add interactions, so dt, t, well, interactions are it's interactions in the quantum field theory sense. This is a particle and a potential, where v of x is some function on the line that the particle moves on. The classical equations of motion are given by the critical locus of S, and you should try to take the entire story I tell you today and put it into Phil and Kevin's formalism, the formalism from their lectures. I'm not going to work at a derived level. So equations of motion, underived, are just critical points of S. And because I think someone has to do it once at the school, and I'll express variational derivatives with deltas. So how do you find the equations of motion? You vary the action. You get a 2. X dot is dtx, dt variation of x plus v prime variation of x, and integrate by parts to rewrite that, assuming no boundary terms, to rewrite that as minus 2. X two derivatives plus v prime of x all multiplied by variation in x, and the equation of motion is this thing. So this is the functional derivative of s with respect to x of t, and classically that thing is zero. In other words, the equation of motion is x double dot is, and I'm sorry, I should have thrown a half into the action, but I didn't write my notes that way, and to keep things consistent, there will be random factors of two floating around. So x double dot is a half v prime of x. And let's let's think about what that means. So suppose we have a potential, say a quadratic potential as appropriate for a harmonic oscillator. And our particle is sitting at some point, x naught at time zero. What does this tell us? So the second derivative of the motion, in other words, the acceleration in x, should be proportional to the derivative of the potential. In other words, x double dot equals x. Well, we know how to solve that equation. The solutions are x naught, e to the plus minus t, and then you stop and think, does that make any sense? So it's trying to say that if the particle starts out at some x naught, it's either going to go increasingly fast in the direction of increasing potential or sort of decay very slowly to zero. And you should be worried about your intuition at this point and think that you've maybe missed a factor of I, and you have, and that's just because we're working in Euclidean time. So in Lorentzian time, really, x of t is, well, constant. E to the plus minus it, in other words, will be a linear combination of cosine t and sine t with some coefficients. And that's more the sort of oscillatory behavior one actually expects. Where the particle goes back and forth in the potential well. The reason I am saying this is just as a caveat. Some intuition may be broken here and later on, and there are factors of I that are important to get the intuition back. Moving on, this is a quantum system, and there are a few basic objects that we're interested in the quantum system. One of them is the set of correlation functions. We want to consider correlation functions of the following form. Meaning doing the path integral over the space of all fields. E to the minus 1 over h bar action with insertions of these O's, where the O's are most generally elements of the space that Kevin discussed. They are local functionals on field space. I'm just going to focus on the limit where they become very, very local, in the sense that that they're really just functions on the jet bundle, the jet space at a point. Um, And by point, I mean a particular value of time t. And so the operators I write, and not just the operators I write, the operators you see in any physics book on quantum mechanics are, they depend on a certain time t. I will also restrict to polynomial functions on the jet space. So they end up looking like x to some power times the first derivative of x to some power times the second derivative of x to some power and so on. The picture you should have in mind is that these operators are arranged somewhere along the line of time. And each of them is a product of x and its derivatives at a particular time. So in general, one should work with these sorts of smooth C infinity functionals, at least for Kevin's formalism, and take limits to get these sorts of x's. Again, I would strongly encourage you to take everything I say and try to throw it into that perspective.
So these things like x of t0 and x dot of t0, that's like what Kevin would have written with like O of delta function at t0.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. So Ben's point was that these were Kevin's O of f's, where f was a delta function. At a point. Now, there are several simplifying steps here. So to simplify this, I'm first going to observe that if what I'm interested in is the set of these sort of polynomial operators on jet space, it suffices to just consider, well, certainly monomials because everything is linear, but in fact to consider degree one monomials, just linear functions. Linear operators of the form x or x prime or x dot or x double dot at a particular point. Why is that? The claim is that arbitrary monomials can be constructed by collision. So here's a simple example. If we have operators x at t and x at t plus epsilon, the limit is epsilon goes to 0 in any correlation function is just going to be the operator x squared at t. More interesting example. if we have x at t and x dot at t plus epsilon, the limit as epsilon goes to 0 in any correlation function is almost the thing you want. It's x of t, x dot at t, with a correction. And the source of that correction was discussed in Kevin's lectures last week from one particular perspective. Doing it the other way of course gives you the other sign. Limit as epsilon goes to 0, x dot at t x at t plus epsilon is x of t, x dot of t plus h bar over 2. And the difference between these things is h bar. And that's the thing that Kevin derived. So the precise statement is that if we take the limit as epsilon goes to 0 in any correlation function of x of t, x dot at t plus epsilon minus x at t plus epsilon, x dot at t, this is the same as replacing this with my signs here, replacing with minus h bar. So that's simplification one. Oh, note, I can always subtract off h bars and recover the more interesting monomial as a collision of elementary ones. Simplification number two is that we can work modulo the equations of motion. This is related to an exercise on a problem sheet early last week. So, any correlation function involving the equations of motion, thought of as a local operator, vanishes. So, what I mean by this is the operator. Whatever it was, x double dot, 2x double dot, minus v prime of x at a particular t where none of the other operators are close to that t. So there's other stuff around, but we have an insertion of the equations of motion here. And that's zero because in the path integral, this is a total derivative. And so what we're really doing is integrating over fields, d mu minus h bar d dx at our particular value of t, call it t zero, e to the 1 over h bar s, and then other stuff. And that's a total derivative and just integrates to 0. Should be 0 in correlation functions. The upshot is that in this bosonic quantum mechanics, the only operators we really need to think about if we're interested in these polynomials are x and x dot. So we can eliminate x double dot with the equations of motion. And then we only need to consider x and x dot. And the collisions of x and x dot are super nice. There's the ones that that were described here. Okay, that's the operator algebra. Now I should say a few things about the Hilbert space, which is sometimes, so in physics, and when one learns quantum mechanics in physics, the Hilbert space and the operator algebra come at once. And any quantum field theory, topologically twisted or otherwise, has a notion of Hilbert spaces. In some of the algebraic formulations, the Hilbert spaces often play a secondary role with respect to the operator algebras.
You don't capture all the possible information just by looking at local operators. There's a bit more there in the Hilbert space, which it is often useful to incorporate. In fact, I think I will try to make very precise in what sense there's a bit more there in the Hilbert space.
Right, so what is this thing? Abstractly, it's a linear representation. This is a linear representation of the operator algebra. Roughly, it's obtained as follows in a classic physics context. It's a geometric quantization of phase space P omega, where phase space is the set of classical solutions to the equations of motion on, you can take various things here. If your theory is fairly well behaved, one can consider equations of motion on a half line from 0 to infinity. Otherwise, I hesitate a bit because you may not know about the long time behavior of some differential equations, in which case you should just take solutions on an infinitesimally small interval from 0 to epsilon. This is always a zero-shifted symplectic space. No. If I have internalized properly the things that Phil has been telling me over the years, the equations of motion are a one-shifted derived object. They're one-shifted symplectic. Please correct me if I'm wrong. At minus one. Thank you. And here we're looking at equations of motion on an interval, and somehow putting them on the interval shifts the shift. And we get back to an ordinary symplectic space, and I'm sure it has something to do with the with cochains on that interval. More concretely, so in the example, our phase space is R2. It's the values of x at time zero that are needed to extend a solution uniquely for a small amount of time. And that's just x and its first derivative. Where does the symplectic structure come from? It's induced by the action. So the symplectic structure is induced by the action. The general idea is this. You consider the action on this small interval, zero epsilon, which for us looked like integral from zero to epsilon, x dot squared plus phi. The first variation produces a boundary term at zero. And that gives us the Liouville one form. On phase space. In the example, sorry, so what I mean by this specifically, it's the first variation restricted to the solution of the equations of motion. If we didn't have boundaries, you vary the action and you restrict to the equations of motion, you obviously get zero. That was the definition of the equations of motion, but here we'll get a boundary term. And that'll be the Liouville one form. So in our example, ds is an integral from zero to epsilon to dtx, dt variation of x, plus v prime variation of x. And we integrate by parts. And when we integrate by parts, we'll get a term at zero and a term at epsilon that I'm ignoring. The term at zero is minus two x dot x. There's something at epsilon, and then there's an integral of the equations of motion, which is zero. And this is, there's a variation there. That's the Liouville one form. So theta is with this weird prefactor, it's minus two x dot delta x. And then the symplectic form is d theta, which is minus two d x dot dx. Okay. And now we quantize with respect to this thing. I was going to say this later, but maybe I'll say it now just for some structure. In local Darboux coordinates,
on phase space, this symplectic form that's derived this way always looks like sum over fields d conjugate momentum to phi wedge d phi. And this conjugate momentum is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to phi dot, where the Lagrangian is the thing that's being integrated to find the action. And so if you don't want to go, sometimes the setup is a little bit tricky, and it's always useful for getting your head straight to go through this exercise to find the symplectic form. But you can often shortcut it by identifying the conjugate momenta and then realizing that the conjugate momentum has to be the canonical conjugate to the field itself. In other words, they form Darboux coordinates on phase space. And again, I apologize to those of you who are bored right now, but I feel like this has to be said at least once at this workshop. So then we should quantize. I'll do it in the example. I'll say it in general and then do it in the example. So what does geometric quantization mean? It means that the Hilbert space should be L2 sections of a line bundle. Of a complex line bundle on P with curvature equal to omega. And one doesn't take all two L2 sections, but those that are polarized according to some choice of polarization. I.e., roughly, independent of half the coordinates. Those of you who have studied D modules, but maybe not geometric quantization, might find this rather familiar thing. We are producing a representation. Sorry, I'm going to defer those comments for a minute. So what happens in our case? This is for us. We're quantizing R2 with respect to this canonical symplectic form. We can choose for these sections to be either independent of x or independent of x dot. It doesn't matter which one you choose. They're related by a Fourier transform. I'll choose functions f of x. And the output of the geometric quantization procedure is not just building the space, but building it as a representation of the operator algebra. So it's with an action such that x just multiplies and x dot differentiates. And now I'll make the D-module comment. So this is just like looking at differential operators on the base of phase space. If you think of phase space as a cotangent bundle, you're looking at differential operators on the base. That's what the operator algebra is. And trying to find a representation for that. And one knows in the world of D-modules from Bernstein's inequality that representations can't be too big. The effective dimension is constrained. In particular, you can consider functions of at most half the variables, and here we'll actually consider functions of half the variables, and that's the representation that comes out. And then we note that there's a commutation relation among these operators acting on the Hilbert space that is compatible with what we found from local operators. Now, the picture here we have, I think those of you who are hidden can see it on the camera, we have a Hilbert space at time zero. And this action on functions is literally happening infinitesimally close to zero. Of course, we're interested in other operators sitting at points that are finitely far away from zero. To get the action of these, we have to use the Hamiltonian. So far, most of what I've said in this quantization of the phase space does not care that there's a potential involved. The potential only comes in when trying to ask, how do operators at finite distance act? And I'm not going to go through that in detail. I'll make a few notes later on. One other note. There's another way to think, another very useful way to think about the Hilbert space. It is roughly modulo things that physicists know and that I don't want to discuss here. It is roughly, also this will be exactly in topological theories, it is roughly functions on this set of boundary conditions for the path integral at a spatial slice. So on the set of boundary conditions for the path integral at t equals zero. And I want to draw another picture for you, and then I'll stop saying anything about Hilbert spaces and correlation functions. So the picture you should have in mind looks like this. Suppose we are working on an interval. From 0 to 1. And we fix x. We fix the particle to be at x naught at time 0 and x 1 at time 1, and throw in a few operators at some intermediate times. Here I'm just drawing two of them. There are two ways to interpret this picture. On one hand, this is a correlation function that's computed by the path integral. So it's an integral over fields. It's an integral over all x of t's such that x at 0 is x0 and x at 1 is x1. With e to the minus 1 over h bar s, and an insertion of local operators in correlation function notation. I could write that as the expectation value of this product of local operators subject to the boundary conditions at 0 and 1. On the other hand, we can express it in terms of Hilbert spaces, or try to express it in terms of Hilbert spaces. As follows, we could try to do the following thing. We start with a delta function state, at time 0, act on it with our local operators, and then take an inner product with a state at time 1 in the dual Hilbert space that is forcing x to be equal to x1. And you should have several problems with this. So I mean that to be an inner product in the Hilbert space H. Potential problems. The biggest one is that the delta function is not actually in L2. That can be remedied, and the way physicists usually describe quantum mechanics is with the remedy where delta becomes a half density, and these inner products do actually make sense. Another way to deal with it now is to just, instead of specifying precise boundary conditions at time 0 and time 1, to give a probability distribution of boundary conditions. In other words, integrate against two functions, f of x and g of x. If we integrate this against f of x at time 0 and g of x at time 1, then we get the following sort of relation, which does have a chance to make sense. This is not horribly poor form. So this becomes integral dx0 f of x0. Integral dx1 g of x1. Probably put a bar in there. And then path integral. So this gets integrated twice, too, against f and g. And now this is something that can make sense. Your other potential complaint is that I didn't tell you how operators that were not at time 0 act on a state at time 0. And again, this is where the Hamiltonian comes in. To interpret, say, a 1 at t1 acting on f of x, we need time evolution. I think I am OK on time. So let me say one very brief thing about this. It's not super important for the rest of these lectures, because I will start topologically twisting things and looking at theories where the time evolution is trivial. In which case, this actually makes sense as written. But in general, there's a thing called the Hamiltonian, which I think will also be derived on the exercise sheet. It's the Lagrangian minus x dot times the derivative with respect to x dot. In this case, that's minus x dot squared plus v of x. And this thing is meant to be interpreted as an operator on the Hilbert space, so acting on functions on Hilbert space, this means minus h bar squared ddx squared plus v of x, where you see a Laplacian showing up. And then what this correlator actually means, or not this correlator, but rather this this product of operators acting on the Hilbert space, so that actually means the following thing. We start with a state f of x, evolve it to time one by multiplying by e to the 1 over h bar times the time times the Hamiltonian, then act with O1 as if it were acting in the representation at 0. And then evolve again from time 2 to time 1, or from time 1 to time 2. And then act with O2, and oh no, and then evolve again from one, or sorry, from T2 to one, the final time, and then take an inner product with G. And now everything lives in the same space, and that inner product all makes sense. Okay. This sort of thing showed up in Davide's talk, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to actually spell it out. These time evolutions were appearing everywhere. One last basic thing, there's something called the state operator correspondence in general in quantum field theories. Typically, in physics, we only talk about it in conformal theories, but as Davide pointed out, a version of it makes sense in any theory. In quantum mechanics, it's particularly simple and looks like this. The state operator correspondence is a relation between the infinite line and the hairpin. It says that the vector space of local operators at a point should be equivalent to the Hilbert space of the theory on two points. In general, these two points are showing up as the link of a single point. So in general, one expects a statement saying that local operators are equivalent to the Hilbert space on the link of a point. But here in one dimension, the link of a point is S0, which is just a disjoint union of two points. And now I flip them around. So we have the Hilbert space on two points times time, which is just, this is two copies of the theory going in opposite directions. And the Hilbert space here is just two copies of the original Hilbert space. And now you have to ask, is this a sensible statement? And I hope yes. And I hope it's actually sort of a tautological statement. So obviously, elements of H tensor H dual are the linear maps from H to H. Okay, so it's kind of tautologically true. Maybe one useful state of thing about this is that the action of this doubled Hilbert space on the original Hilbert space, or rather, let me say it differently. So here I told you about a correspondence of vector spaces, but local operators form an algebra. They can be collided. And you might wonder how that algebra structure is encoded here. And again, it may be sort of tautological. You just keep multiplying H tensor H dual and contracting. But a different way to look at that is the following. If we think of the Hilbert space on point union point times time, as L2 of R cross R, and there is some functional analysis that is a little funky here, and you guys should know how to correct it. So the Hilbert space on point cross point is the Hilbert space of two copies of the theory. Phase space is two copies of the phase space that I analyzed over here, which means we expect this Hilbert space to be L2 functions on R cross R. So things of the form of X, X prime. Then the product and the action on a single Hilbert space comes from convolution. In other words, this k acts on a function of x in the single Hilbert space by convolving. And I'm bringing this up because this is a feature that's going to recur over and over, either in these talks or in other things you read, or in Justin's afternoon talk about the BFN construction. That BFN convolution is this convolution. And you can say things about Riesz representation theorem and whatnot. Anyway, this is just an integral kernel representation of local operators. And the tricky functional analysis is that you would want things like multiplication by x and differentiation with respect to x to be in here, and they're not quite in here. You need delta functions, and there are ways to deal with that. Okay, any questions? Yes, where? Oh, yes, totally. Elements of the Hilbert space are called wave functions. And if we were doing Lorentzian theory, they would literally be, well, even here, they're Lorentzian. They're probability distributions for a particle to be at a given position x here and here. These are the wave functions. Thanks, Nick. Anything else? Cool. All right. So. I also, that's been like an hour of going of a fractured revision of quantum mechanics. If you guys need to stand up and stretch and shake your heads out and shake your arms out, feel free to do so. I want to repeat a few things for fermions, and then talk about supersymmetry connecting with C's lectures from last week. So I just said bosonic quantum mechanics. Now I'm going to do fermionic quantum mechanics much faster. So fermionic particles move on the Grassmann line. So real fermions in one dimension. Our field is going to be a map from spacetime to the shifted line. Grassmann variables anti-commute. This is something I'm assuming you do all know. In particular, values, the values of this function at different t's will anti-commute. And in particular, the value of this function at a single t squared is zero. Now, if this fermionic field is being treated as a section of a spin bundle on R, the sort of equation of motion it should satisfy is a Dirac equation. We would like to write down a first-order Lagrangian, or a first-order action involving just one time derivative for this field psi. And there's a slight problem with that. If we do the naive thing and just write psi, time derivative psi, well, that's time derivative of psi squared, which is zero. And there's no way to write a non-degenerate kinetic term for a single fermion. You need at least two. So if we have two real fermions, we can actually write down this action. Sorry? From? But it's still zero. I mean, that's true, but it's also zero.
What are we missing? I don't see the y qualities.
Because time derivative is a derivation, and that is true, but this is zero. This is psi squared at a single value of time. Is that?
If I just compute, I get dt psi psi plus psi.
Oh, did I screw something up? I probably screwed something. No, I didn't screw anything up. there's a factor of two around. There. Sorry. I was trying to motivate complex fermions. you're right. So this is dt psi plus psi dt psi. Oh, it's totally fine, isn't it? No, it's not fine. Sorry guys. You're absolutely right. I got myself over confused last night. One fermion is fine. We will, however, consider two. Anyway. Thanks. I will consider two. The action will look like this. That's the sort of thing you'd write down for n equals one. Action looks like that. Integrating by parts, it's the same thing as as the order of reversed combination. Equivalently, I'll take one complex fermion, thought of as a map from time to parity shifted C, with its conjugate psi dagger, or psi bar. Now, in mathematical or algebraic approaches or doing TQFT, one often just thinks of these as two independent fermions without thinking about whether they're real or complex. But they're two fermions together with an involution. So our fields are psi and psi bar. And there's a dagger involution, which I don't think is going to contain the factors of I's that came in C's talk. The dagger involution just, it's a dagger, I guess, anti-involution. It sends psi psi bar to psi bar psi. Also, for the record, in Euclidean space, time derivative dagger will be minus time derivative, and if we have a sequence of fermions dagger, we get the conjugates of the same sequence in reverse. With respect to this involution, the action is fixed. In other words, the action, if you think of this as complex conjugation, the action is real. So S dagger is S, and you should check that. And now let's go through the basic ingredients that I talked about for bosonic quantum mechanics. What are the local operators, at least the polynomial ones? We should only consider, or it suffices to only consider linear monomials. But now the equations of motion eliminate the first derivatives. The equations of motion from, I didn't even write the action down, sorry guys. So the action in the complex case looks just like it does there. It's psi bar dt psi. And the equations of motion are very, very simple here. This is a free fermion, dt psi and dt psi bar are both zero. And that eliminates the first derivatives, and so we're only left with two operators to look at. And they're they satisfy anti-commutation relations if we take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. Of the operators placed in opposite orders, now with the plus sign, we'll end up with h bar. The Hamiltonian is zero. So this is our first example of a topological theory. There's no time evolution. It doesn't matter where these operators are inserted. unless I also made a mistake last night, which I don't think I did. So and the canonical conjugate of, so if we take, if we differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to psi dot, we'll just get up to a sine psi bar, and if we differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to psi bar, we'll get up to a sine psi. So we expect the phase space to consist of functions of psi and psi bar. Since the equations of motion are first order, if we're trying to solve them on for a small amount of time, it suffices to know the values of psi and psi bar at zero. And computing canonical conjugates tells us that the symplectic form should look like, sorry, functions of, these lectures are too long for me. So the phase space consists, what am I trying to say? It's the phase space consists of the values of psi and psi bar at zero. And the symplectic form is d psi, d psi bar. And the Hilbert space is now going to be functions of one of the variables alone. So this is functions of, say, just psi, But functions of psi are a very simple thing. That's algebraic. They're things of the form A psi plus B. And so as a vector space, that thing is just C2. Okay. So now, right, so the Hilbert space is C2. If we think of a vector A psi plus B as a column vector, then psi, which acts as multiplication, can be just identified with the 2x2 matrix that looks like that. And psi bar, which acts as H bar derivative, gets identified with the transpose, and the commutation relations, so the anti-commutator, keep using C's notation, of psi and psi bar, which is, so that's psi psi bar plus psi bar psi, in terms of matrices, very nicely, is H bar times the identity. So that is a much simpler realization of Hilbert space and operators than we saw before. And now the state operator correspondence is exact. There's no functional analysis involved. And the state operator correspondence looks like this. We expect operators at a point which we know are polynomials in psi and psi bar. And if you think of this as an algebra, it's polynomials in psi and psi bar with the commutation relation psi psi bar plus psi bar psi. H bar. So this should be the Hilbert space on a hairpin. And this is just, so now the Hilbert space on two points is just two copies of our original Hilbert space, which is C2 times C2. Now the product can be thought of either as a convolution product or multiplication of matrices or whatever you like. There are lots of ways to write it. Any questions about that?
So you wrote your Lagrangian for the fermions at psi bar d t psi?
Yes. That is the Dirac operator in one dimension. Yes, there's secretly a little gamma matrix in here. But in the wonderful thing about one dimension is that one doesn't need to include all of that technology. It's very simple. Other questions? Yes, also, please ignore what I said earlier about the Hamiltonian being zero. Really have been going back over calculations that I have not done in a long time. Okay, so last thing I want to say is what the upgrade to supersymmetry looks like. Yeah. Well, for fermions, polynomials in C infinity or L2 functions are the same thing. And for bosons, they're not. So one has to be super careful. One way to deal with it is to, in the bosonic case, is to not consider these delta functions at all, or like the operators at a point, but to consider like little local densities, like as in Kevin's talk, where he had like theta f and theta star g. And then I think everything ought to work. So I'm not sure exactly what to say, except one has to be very careful. In the topological models, we'll start discussing this will actually be an equivalence. And you should expect it to be an equivalence upon some appropriate completion. Okay, so, right. Let me say a few relevant things about supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and then I will leave everything else for the exercise sheet this afternoon. So I want to do one-dimensional n equals 2 supersymmetry. The easiest way to do this is in superspace, exactly as in C's talk. And so a lot of this will look familiar. The relevant superspace is R. I'll write it as R times parity reversed C, where the coordinate here is time, and the coordinates here are theta and theta bar. And there will be a dagger involution. That swaps the bars and leaves T alone. A superfield is a function on superspace. A function on ordinary R and parity reversed C can be Taylor expanded so that it looks like this. We'll have four components. It's useful to put a minus sign there. Where the four components are ordinary fields. And at the beginning of the day, one should choose whether the overall function is bosonic or fermionic.
You forgot to write a theta
I did. So one should choose whether the overall function is bosonic or fermionic. Here I have assumed bosonic. So A and B are bosonic fields, and alpha and beta are fermionic. But just as well, I could have considered maybe a parity shifted functions, in which case A and B would be fermionic and alpha and beta would be bosonic. These are all examples of superfields. The reason for looking at functions on superspace is that they come with a canonical action of the supersymmetry algebra. So what Siyu explained last time was that there were these left and right invariant vector fields on superspace, which for us, very concretely, look like d theta minus theta bar dt. So these are the left invariant vector fields. They're Q's and they're D's. And you should think and check that the graded commutator of the Q's is 2dt, and the graded commutator of the D's is minus 2dt, but the Q's and the D's commute with each other. And they act on functions on superspace. So they act on superfields, and that induces an action on components. Which I will leave as an exercise. Using superspace gives us representations of the supersymmetry algebra, which is this. The representation is reducible. And one can say general things about reducing these representations. In 1D n equals 2, there are two extremely important ways to reduce that general representation. One of them is to extend this dagger involution to the entire supersymmetry algebra. Assuming that dagger acts with a minus sign in the conjugation on the derivatives, the involution extends to the algebra. It already acts on fields. It preserves the supersymmetry part of it. The dagger of this equation is the same equation. That means that we can get smaller representations of the supersymmetry algebra by looking at fixed points of the dagger involution. So we can get a representation of Wendy n equals 2 Suzy by restricting to fixed points of Dagger, in other words, to real superfields. This should actually be a minus dt, yes. And that's also a weird, it should be a, yes. Yes, there are weird minus signs floating around. It's a...
Is there a reason for that besides it's weird?
Yes. Yeah, so what I want to say is that it's an adjoint operation. Yes. So it's a differential operator that's being whose adjoint we're taking. There are different. I also need to say that there are all sorts of different conventions, and there was C's notation that involved vector factors of I, and we've done something weird because I'm actually secretly working in Euclidean conventions, and there's an extra factor of I in all the T's that comes from working in Euclidean time. This is one consistent Dagger involution. The real superfields look like this, and I will stop in another 2 minutes. I'll only consider the bosonic ones, and I don't think they are fermionic ones, and the bosonic ones look like this. They have a leading real bosonic component. And then a conjugate fermion pair. And then another real bosonic component at the top. Doing quantum mechanics, doing supersymmetric quantum mechanics with real superfields leads to Matt's Durham quantum mechanics. So this leads to Durham cohomology. In a way that will appear on the exercise sheet. There's another option. Since the Q's commute with the D's, we can use the D's to constrain fields. So we can restrict to a superfield such that d bar of phi is zero. This is called a chiral superfield, and the constraint can be solved so that in components phi looks like it has a complex bosonic component and a fermion and then the constraint forces the rest of the components to take this form where the theta bar term is zero and the top theta bar component is just the derivative of the original one, of phi. The dagger of this satisfies d phi dagger is zero, and it's called antichiral. And to construct actions, one needs both of these things. And finally, there are fermionic versions. So there is a chiral fermionic superfield. Sometimes just called a Fermi superfield. Gamma that satisfies d bar gamma is zero, and there is the anti-chiral gamma dagger. So when we look at these fields that are restricted by using d bars or d's, there are both bosonic and fermionic versions available, and doing supersymmetric quantum mechanics with these sorts of multiplets, these sorts of superfields, leads to Matt's Hermitian models. In general, Hermitian models with odd vector bundles on top. So this leads to Dalbeau cohomology. Whether you get one or the other depends entirely on what sorts of multiplets or what sorts of superfields you're using in the quantum mechanics. All right. Thanks. I will now stop. Questions? Yes. So these are closed under the action of supersymmetry, is what I was trying to say. Since the Q's commute with the D's, these components on their own form a representation of the supersymmetry algebra. There's an action of the Q's on the components of this thing alone, for example, or over here. Any other questions, comments? I would be happy for feedback, or let me know what you want to hear in future talks.